I had mentioned to you that Area 51, that's that name of that base, had permeated throughout the popular culture. And this is an example. My producer, Chris Boros, dug up a whole long list of songs that are about Area 51 or themed about Area 51. That's one of them. A guy named Billy Thompson. Sounds like ZZ Top kind of, but you might have heard a reference in those lyrics to the Groom Lake Yacht Club, which they used to sell T-shirts, Groom Lake Yacht Club T-shirts when this story first broke. There's some other songs that we'll be hearing through the night with an Area 51 theme. And we'll also be talking about some other people who've come forward with their own tales about Area 51 of varying degrees of credibility, including a guy named Boyd Bushman, who made a whole bunch of news a couple of weeks ago with his deathbed confession about things going on out there. We pick up our conversation with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. All right, in just a moment, we're going to get into some details about what Bob Lazar saw at this facility that came to be known as S4. But I want to go back to something we touched on before the break, and it's about your memory, Bob. Maybe Gene, you can talk a little bit about it. People would say, how can Bob not remember X, Y, or Z? If he really was in this program, he should remember everything he did out there. Do you suspect, based on the description Bob just gave us about this green liquid, that maybe something was done to his memory? And can you address, as his friend, the general idea about how his mind works on everyday stuff?
Now, I don't know that they tried to alter his memory, but remember, there are a lot of things we haven't covered here. The security checks, even when they indoctrinated him out of Area 51 and or down at S4, they were poking fingers in his chest, and armed guards would put guns to his head. All of this, you know, to remind him that he's taken this oath of secrecy. And so, you know, this was to imprint his memory to be afraid of them and to not dare expose anything that he was, you know, told or exposed to out there. So that would imprint his memory, but I don't know that that would alter his memory of day-to-day events. And remember, you know, he's not going to work on computers. I mean, after he reached the briefings, I mean, this guy's working on flying saucers or flying discs that were brought in from another star system. It's pretty overwhelming. And I remember when things started getting nasty, when the security briefings, when the threats to him started becoming more often and more severe, I suggested that he start taking note of the names of the people that were doing this. He was so absorbed in the surroundings and the environment and the tasks at hand, which were, you know, mind-boggling. I mean, you know, everyone had a badge on with their picture and their name, and I was the one to suggest that he start memorizing some of these people's names just in case he ever did need to remember who they were should things go really bad, which ultimately they did.
Bob, do you think that they messed with your memory, that stuff that you drank? I mean, certainly they intimidated you, right?
I don't think so. I don't know if the technology existed back then. I don't know how much that technology exists today. You know, to selectively affect memories. But, you know, I never experienced any memory loss to any degree.
Wait a second now, because you would say that there were times when you'd fly up there, you didn't know when you got home, you didn't know what you'd done that day, didn't you?
Well, that is true. But that's pretty much been that way my entire life. I mean, I don't know what I had for dinner last night, you know, so that's, I'm just not the best guy as far as memory goes.
Address the idea that I approached earlier before the break about why you would be a guy to be hired at a program like this, because you've heard it so many times over the years. Bob is not the kind of guy they would ever hire for this. He's too wild. He's got unconventional beliefs.
That's exactly what they were looking for, and they made that clear to me. I said, we really wanted somebody out in left field. We keep going over the same thing, and we keep getting the same results. And, you know, they mentioned Dr. Teller's recommendation, you know, that this is a guy that just might look at things differently. And I think they wanted somebody to think outside the box.
I think they also picked you because you could be discredited if things went awry.
I'm sure that was the case, because I would, as I've always said, I'm an extremely easy guy to discredit. So, yeah, if you look at all these things, who else would you pick?
George,
go ahead.
You know, Bob says he can't remember things very well, and you say sometimes he wouldn't remember what he did at work that specific day. But on the whole, I mean, he remembered the specifics of a wide range of information. I mean, think of all of the things this guy has brought forward back then, and of course, it's remained the same for the past 25 years. So while, you know, he might not think he's got immediate memory, I mean, don't you think he did a great job of remembering specifics about a wide range of information?
Absolutely. What I was getting to is, well, Bob's the kind of guy that...
I'd like to clarify that.
Sure.
I couldn't remember what I did that day. And that wasn't to say that, you know, I got home and I don't remember anything. I mean, we're talking about specifics of what I specifically did that day.
I guess the point I was making, Bob, is knowing you well enough after all these years, is you're the kind of guy, I mean, I do the same thing. If I'm thinking about something, I'll drive by right by my own house if my head is into something. Or, I mean, your brain can be preoccupied and you don't remember the kinds of stuff that everybody else would think about, mundane, everyday stuff.
Yeah, that's just me, and you have to know me to know that. You know, it's kind of, as people have said it, you know, this guy is the typical absent-minded professor. So,
well, but if he's working on a flying saucer, can you blame him because he can't remember the name of the guy he was working with? You know, that's, you know, he's being confronted with technology from another star system. It's a matter of priority. You know what I mean? I don't think he was paying attention to things that were less important than that.
Let's go back to, I wish I hadn't jumped out of the order, but the first day you go up there, you get hired. The first day you go up there, you had to sign a bunch of papers. And is that the first day you read the briefing book? Did you get a look at what was in the briefing book about all kinds of weird technology and where it came from? Or has that come later?
Well, that was down that was actually down at S4. Now, they gave me some other overall briefings, and it was mostly security at Area 51, you know, where that plane landed, Area 51 proper. And as Gene mentioned, you know, it was mainly just hammering the security of the place, you know, into my head, how things go, where you go, what you do, and, you know, who you talk to. And, you know, one of the main things they brought up was, you know, if people keep asking you what you do up here, you know, what you tell them, you can make things up or, you know, tell them, hey, I just can't say. But if they push it more than three times, they want to know that person's name and how to contact them. So, you know, they were really concerned about the spread of information of any kind, or even that I had any work to do up there, or even had traveled up there.
By the time you got hired, you already knew John Lear. It would seem to me they would go, aha, that's a flashpoint. There's no way we're hiring some guy who knows John Lear, the crazy UFO guy who's spreading all these stories. That alone would be a disqualifier. What do you say about that? Did they raise the issue of John Lear?
Yeah, they actually mentioned John Lear's name. And actually, if I can step out of that question for a minute, Kathy Thomas, who you met, who worked at, what's the big satellite installation in Mojave?
Oh, yeah. The Great Big Dishes.
The VLA?
Yeah, right.
The VLA?
VLA. I think it's the Goldstone.
Yes.
Anyway, you knew her too, Gene, right? She recently died, but what I'm getting at is, when she left Goldstone, she applied around and she actually got a job at Area 51. And she used me as a reference on the form, which we thought was hilarious. You know, I said, Kathy, if there's ever been a person not to put on your application, it's me. But she got the job. So, you know, going back to talking or mentioning John Lear, you know, obviously, if you could put me as a reference on there and get into Area 51, although I didn't use John as a reference, they had gone over every person I know or knew at that time, friends, family, whatnot, and, you know, what they did, their relationship, so on and so forth. But you know, obviously they weren't that concerned about John.
Well, or maybe they liked the idea that you knew. Gene, you were going to say?
Well, I think to just take one step back again to the security briefings at Area 51, I think it's important to note that he also, by executive order, signed his rights away to due process, that if anything went wrong, it would be handled by a civilian court-martial out there. And, of course, it's supposed to be illegal to sign your civil rights away, but that was a requirement for him to get into this program. Was by the, I think, wasn't Ronald Reagan's signature on that, Bob?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, so he had to sign his right to due process away to work at this facility.
The word magic or majestic, where did you first see that? Because, you know, as you know, that's a very controversial term in ufology, whether a majestic 12-like organization really existed. Was that the name of it, or were they messing with you?
No, that was, I mean, the MAJ was on my badge. And I always thought that, maybe I was stretching, but I always thought that that was an abbreviation for majestic. And I know John Lear produced the MJ-12 documents and showed me those. Now, I don't really recall the history of that or if that was the first instance of majestic or majestic 12 being mentioned. But I did believe. Now I can't say for sure. I think I did question Barry, who was my coworker at the time, and mentioned the MAJ on the badge. And I can't remember if he verified that it was short for majestic or what his comment was on it. But you know, I was always under the impression that that's what it was.
George, so does the audience know who the Majestic 12 are?
In general, yeah. Majestic 12 is supposed to be this all-powerful overlord, this panel of people who control access to all UFO information, crash saucers, things of that sort. Highly controversial, even in the world of ufology, about whether this panel really existed or not, because the source of the documents that mention it, that came forward, how they came forward is highly controversial to this day. Let's go back to you,
well,
Bob.
You know, on that same note, you know, they... a lot of questions I get asked have to do with security. And one of them was, oh, you know, my grandfather had the highest security clearance, you know, in whatever force he was in, Army, Navy, or Air Force. And, you know, he would certainly have known about this. You know, you don't automatically get to know everything when you, you know, attain high security clearances. They're very specific. And one of the things I was told, at that time, there were only 22 people who had knowledge and information about the whole extraterrestrial program, the fact that we had recovered crafts there and, you know, the back engineering, the fact that Papoose, but at that time, there were only 22 people and, you know, they had us go over that list. That list was always, always available. And, you know, that's an incredibly small amount of people for such a mind-boggling project. And that's one thing that always, it really shocked me. But they were so concerned about security and, you know, the potential leakage that they wanted to keep it as small as possible. But in any case, that was really all the people that knew about it at that time.
Let's talk about compartmentalization a little bit. You know, since we worked on this story, I've got to know a lot of people who worked at Area 51, some who are still working out there, people who had been there in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, working on all kinds of different projects. And invariably, they will say, Bob Lazar was never here. I never saw him at Area 51. That's number one. Number two, if there had been a project like this, I would know about it. But in the same breath, they would tell me, I worked with a guy and every day saw him in the chow line for 5 years and I never knew what he worked with. Or they would tell me, I had to lie to my wife, I had to tell her something else. We've seen briefing documents and pamphlets from out there that they give to the workers that say, here's how you lie and here's how to make up a story about what you do.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. That was part of the security information I got too. And as far as Area 51, I didn't work. I wasn't stationed at Area 51 proper. The only time I was there you know, for any length of time was the first time, and I was in a single room. I wasn't, you know, hanging out there, you know, mingling with people. When the plane landed, I went from the plane into a bus and drove south to S4, and no one from Area 51 proper was allowed down at S4. If people worked at Area 51, we would never cross paths.
I'd like to point this out, is that, you have critics, and it's understandable why you'd have critics who argue about your credentials, your work history. He can't prove this. He can't prove that. But they have to overlook a lot of stuff to disregard your story. One of being the existence of a place called S4. There had never been an S4 on any maps. No one had ever printed it. There had been no news stories about it. It wasn't any newspaper accounts. It had never appeared in public until you said that there was a place called S4. And I'll just tell the audience that I had called Nellis Air Force Base in 1989 to their public information office and asked them, do you have an S4? And they came back and reluctantly, I think, told me, yes, it is a real place. They said, we can't tell you where it is and we can't tell you what goes on there, but yes, we have S4. In fact, we have more than one. Today, if you call Nellis Air Force Base and ask them, and I did with our friend Jeremy Corbell, we asked them, do you have S4? Is there someplace like that? They said, we can't find it on any map, which is not the same as saying it doesn't exist. It's just that it's not on a map, which has always been the case. But the fact that you knew about S4, that it really was a place that existed and nobody else had ever mentioned it before, and then Nellis confirms it, says a lot.
Well, and then the skeptics go, well, that doesn't mean there were flying saucers there.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, let's talk about flying saucers. You went down, you get on the bus, you go down to this facility. It's built into the side of this slope designed to look like desert floor, and you go inside. The first day you're inside, did you see all these hangars? Did you see what was in them?
No, actually, we had been driving down around the side of the hangars, and there was, for lack of a better term, an office entrance door that took you down the long corridor into the facility. And this one time I went down, we stopped at the hangar doors because one was open, and clearly in there was a flying disc. And as I've said before, this is, you know, the stereotypical flying saucer. It was very sleek looking. I gave it the name the Sport model later on because of the other units they had there. This was the sleekest looking and, you know, most impressive as far as I was concerned. We disembarked the bus at that point and we walked directly through the hangar, and with the express purpose of showing me what was in there. Now, when I walked in there, again, remember, I still am not buying into UFO stories, and I was convinced that I was right at this point, and I thought this fully explained why so many people thought they were flying saucers. I thought, oh, okay, this is our new advanced fighter. It looks like a flying saucer, so people think there are aliens and stuff flying around. I mean, all the pieces fit together. And, you know, even when I went by it, it had a little American flag stuck on it. And, you know, it all made perfect sense.
For a while.
Yeah, for a while. Until I realized what we were up to.
Wasn't the flag upside down?
Yeah, it was.
Which indicates what?
Well, no, it wasn't upside down. It was backwards.
Right, right. But does that indication that of stress or...
I have no idea what that
that's
means.
Upside
I just
down, yeah.
That the flag's backwards stuck on there.
We're going to a break in about a minute, so we got time to still tell the story about the posters. You saw these posters in these offices. What was on the posters?
The poster was the craft I was talking about, flying just a little bit above Papoose Lake, and it said, "They're here." And I was always amazed at that time. You know, at that time there were no, right around when the internet was new, and you know there weren't any high quality poster printers like you can pick up now at, you know, Best Buy or large
sort of
format.
Like,
so these guys actually had to have this stuff printed because they were regular like lithographed posters.
They're here, and a picture of the Sport model. Somebody's inside joke there. We'll come back and hear more of Bob Lazar's astounding tale. Right after this, the Flying Burrito Brothers singing about Area 51. Take us into the break. Keep on rocking in the free world. One of Neil Young's angriest, most sardonic, and most biting social commentaries. Neil, obviously not too happy with the way things were going back in 1989 when that story was released and when that song was released. And I think the same could be said of Bob Lazar and Gene Huff, because things got pretty ugly for them and their immediate associates as well once Lazar started talking about the things he was seeing at the S4 facility in the Nevada desert. We're getting into the heart of the Lazar tale right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Moments ago, Bob Lazar was telling us about being out at this facility called S4, seeing what he later dubbed the sport model, sitting there in a hangar, and thinking to himself, well, that explains why we have so many UFO reports. It's because it's a secret program. It's one of our jets designed to look like a flying saucer. Bob, at what point did you realize we didn't make it?
Well, I guess the true confirmation came once I had hands-on with the technology. I did read briefings, essentially overviews of what the project was, but, you know, even reading those, I questioned what I was reading.
That it was this is astonishing stuff, saying this technology is from somewhere else, right?
Yeah. That these were extraterrestrial craft. And, the project of analyzing this device is split into several different project groups. I was one of them. And,
Project Galileo was the disks, and
Sidekick was
Looking Glass and Sidekick, right?
Yeah.
What was Looking Glass and what was Sidekick?
Sidekick was a weapon potential, and Looking Glass had to do with, there was always a question, you know, if you can manipulate gravity, you can manipulate time. And, that dealt with, you know, is this a reasonable thing to think about? Is the craft, you know, is it possible that it can affect time? And we're talking about, you know, milliseconds of time distortion, you know, or to seconds, not traveling in time.
So do you think that there was... there were other groups of people out there who were working on those parts of the project?
Right. And we were not permitted to talk, you know, between groups. We had, each group was compartmentalized, and we had, it kind of worked on the buddy system. You know, you had your guy you can talk to about your project, and in, you know, rare circumstances, there was crossover, you know, where you were shown, you know, perhaps another component could possibly interface with what you were doing. So, you know, you had a supervised meeting, you know, with those guys, and they answered specific questions about it. But they were so over the top with security and compartmentalization, it really neutered the whole project. I mean, things moved so slow because of that, and we could have gotten so much done so much faster if they had just been a little more open.
We'll come back to that.
Misremembering this, or... wasn't Sidekick, didn't you tell me that was a beam weapon focused with a gravity lens?
Yes, that's exactly what it was.
So you're talking about security being omnipresent. You talked about the briefing documents and how unbelievable this stuff was. Did you think that all this, the briefing documents included alien autopsy photos, talking about Zeta Reticuli as being the source of this material or this technology? Did you think they were just messing with your head?
Yeah, I thought that was a distinct possibility, because there was so much of this information. It was so outlandish, and I had no idea really what they were trying to push here. So, you know, I digested what I could, and, you know, we continued on. This was very early in, you know, my introduction to what's going on. But when the day finally came that I, you know, met my partner, Barry was his name, at hands-on, he worked in the lab. He was anxious to show me where we were, what we were doing. And as we started going over, you know, some of the equipment that had been removed from the craft, it became immediately obvious that this is technology that not only didn't exist, that was so far advanced, it was borderline magic. And that's when it hit me. really like a sledgehammer of, you know, what we're really dealing with here, and, you know, rewrote my entire thought process about UFOs, extraterrestrials, and the technology involved with it.
Well, let's talk about the technology, the magic. What was magical?
Well, the number one thing is the control of gravity. There's no machine that mankind has made at this point that can produce gravity. Like, we can make an electromagnet, you energize it, and, you know, we can produce a magnetic field to pick up metal. We can, you know, control most other forms of energy, you know, from, you know, lasers and light. We have machines that can accelerate particles to near the speed of light. But the one thing, the one big gap we have is that we can't control this force known as gravity. And if we had a machine that you could turn on and make gravity or repel gravity, we could, the whole world of science fiction suddenly becomes fact. There would be force fields, there would be, you know, movement in time, there would be propulsion without jets or propellers, silent field propulsion. And anyway, that being said, one of the first things he showed me was the operational power source in this vehicle, removed from the vehicle, and that it produced its own gravitational field artificially.
What did it look like? How did it work?
It looked like, the sphere, half a sphere, about the size of a basketball on, about an 18-inch square plate. So that was about the size of it, the overall shape. It was extremely efficient in that it didn't, and, you know, like, this is in violation of one of the laws of thermodynamics. Any system has to produce waste heat to some degree, but this did not. And the entire system operated like a perfectly tuned ballet. There was no waste. This was a small accelerator that used an exotic element that we hadn't seen before that produced and focused gravitational waves and transmitted them through the craft, much the same way as that we route microwaves through tuned pipes. This was all shocking technology and, you know, something that just didn't exist.
So this was a reactor, the power source that had been taken out of one of the craft, and it was sitting there in your workspace, and this guy Barry was showing you how it worked.
Yeah, he energized it. The reactor actually powered the gravity generators and the emitters, but the reactor itself produced its own gravitational wave almost as a byproduct. But with the device running, you could not put your hand on it. And that was, you know, the moment where it became, you know, all became real to me, because that's physically impossible.
How did he demonstrate that to you?
With the golf ball?
The golf ball. But, to get the feeling, it felt exactly like if you ever take two large magnets with like poles and try and, you know, push them together. It's kind of a little rebound, and it becomes more difficult the closer the magnet gets to it. But that was occurring with my hand against this device. So it was really shocking. And to show me that the field was elastic to some degree, Barry took a golf ball and threw it at it, and it rebounded off the field and knocked the ceiling tile out. And we were both in temporary panic to get the ceiling tile replaced before security came by and saw that we were, you know, goofing around. But in any case, that was the device and the moment where everything changed in my mind.
There's a story you've told me and told Gene before about an experiment or a demonstration with a flame that really cemented it. I think the audience would like to hear that one.
Yeah, this still really makes no sense to me. And, you know, and I had witnessed it. The gravity, the reactor itself indirectly connects to the emitters, which are these three large tubes, essentially, that hang underneath the craft. And that's what focus and disperses the gravity waves. Anyway, again, one of those was also removed from the craft, connected to the reactor. And Barry lit a candle, and it was sitting there flickering. And at the focal point of the tube, the gravity emitter, he again fired up the reactor, and the flame froze. Now, it continued to emit light, but it wasn't flickering anymore. It was essentially frozen in time, like there was a picture of it. And what's always confused me is you shouldn't be able to see it, because it really did freeze in time through the action of gravity. The photon should stop being emitted, and, you know, you wouldn't see the candle anymore, much less the area around it. But it was just a frozen flame just sitting there, and that was... it was mind-boggling.
Phase shifted out of time, is that what it was?
Yeah, that's essentially how I've described it. And, in fact, he went one step further, and I think as I mentioned that, he turned up the power in the emitter, and we took the candle out, and he made a little black area where the light was bent away from it, just a small little sphere looking like, you know, a two-dimensional disc. But... where he could actually bend light. Now, gravity's the only thing that can do that. So, you know, here was a working device or system, really, because it consisted of several parts, where you can artificially produce, focus, and control gravity, which gives you an amazing propulsion system. And gravity and time are, you know, very closely intertwined. So, you know, it really allows you to do things that only exist in science fiction movies.
Well, you've heard that since, Bob, is that when this, you know, when some of the details were released, you have scientists who will say, you know, they'll think about it and say, well, you know, gosh, that kind of makes sense. But most of them would say, ah, oh, that's ridiculous. It goes against the law of thermodynamics or whatever. I mean, you understand why people would have trouble with this.
Yeah, these are the comments that I made when I saw it.
Right.
You know, you have some guys that, oh, boy, you missed this. And no, I didn't miss any of that. All of that became, you know, incredibly obvious that this was violating. Look, these aren't theories. Some of the things, you know, we call laws are pretty much proven through, you know, experiments and through time that, look, we can call this a law because it's just impossible, you know, to break this law of nature. Or of physics. And, you know, it's a big deal when one of those things is being violated.
So tell me, you mentioned later that there are 9 of these discs, 9 hangars, 9 discs, which you described as the variety pack. How did you get to know that? Did you get to wander around and see them?
Now, as we were going out to go into the disc, the hangars have large bay doors all between them, and they were all open. And you could see down into all the other hangars, and every hangar had a disc in it. Each one was different. In fact, one of them was standing up on its side and had a large hole in it, like they had shot a projectile through it. But like I said, now, I don't know the story on the other discs. I was only permitted to work and have knowledge about this one. And like I said, it was the sleekest of them all, which is why I gave it the, you know, nickname, the sport model. But, yeah, there were 9 discs in all. And this, from what I was told, had a power system and propulsion system that was common to all of them. And that's about all the knowledge I have about the other discs.
You got to see the sport model. in action.
Yeah, I got to walk in it, see it in action, and take it apart. So I was pretty intimately involved with it. One of the
What was the nail in the coffin of who had been flying this thing? You haven't explained yet when you first entered the sport model what you saw.
Well, the reason they were leading me inside was, again, you know, we were involved with the power and propulsion of the craft. And in case the location of these components is critical to the understanding or duplication of the technology, it was important I see where they went, where they were removed from. So that's why I was being led into the craft. And when I went in there, it was extremely sparse. And there were three small seats in there. You know, it looked like they were, part of a tea set for a little kid. Those little tables and chairs. But they, I mean, very small. You would think if, a humanoid creature would sit in something like that, he'd have to be about 3.5 or 4 feet tall. So obviously the craft was made for something small. And, you know, that was obvious trying to get in the thing, too. It wasn't comfortable to stand in.
You made the remark to me, Bob, in our first interview. You said it had small furniture.
Yeah, I use the word furniture because I was being interviewed for the first time there, and I could not think of the word seats. So I was just, and I was also so concerned about saying this stuff on the air, I was just paralyzed. That was just, a senior moment at the time. But yeah, that's why I called it furniture.
He said it looked like it was made for a toddler when he first told me that's how small they were.
Yeah, unusually small, like a little kid's place.
Well, we can read into that what we will, but you got to see a test. In addition to walking into this craft, you got to see a test, right?
Yeah, apparently it wasn't scheduled that way because Barry and I were working in the lab, and Dennis, kind of the overall supervisor from what I've ever been able to ascertain, came in and said, come on, Bob, there's a test in progress. And he took me out of the lab. We went down into the hangar, and the craft was already outside the hangar. I don't know how they got it there, whether they dragged it, rode it, or flew it out there. But it was already sitting on the ground right outside the hangar door, and they were in communication with it with what appeared to me to be an ordinary radio. Ordinary VHF radio. And again, this caused a question in my mind, because if this thing's producing an enveloping gravitational field, it's going to bend and distort the radio waves to it. So how are they going to talk to anybody in the craft? But obviously they were. So, you know, there's things I don't know about communication with the craft. But in either case, the craft slowly lifted off the ground. It had some purple-blue corona discharge on the bottom, not very bright, but it was noticeable, like you would see around high-voltage systems or Tesla coils, that produced a hiss. And as it lifted about 4 or 5 feet off the ground, that dissipated, and it just stood there motionless in the air, which was incredibly impressive for something large and silent to be sitting there. It moved over to the left and to the right and sat back down. That was the extent of the test. But it was very, very impressive.
So it didn't, like, you didn't get into it and fly to Venus in the blink of an eye, and there weren't aliens sitting in it
who welcomed you into the
craft.
No, it was retrofitted for a human pilot, and it was a very short test. And, this is a prized possession. They're not taking this out and joyriding it. Or doing anything where they would, potentially lose or damage it.
Although I was just kidding about it. Hmm? I mean, but it could have gone to Venus. It could have gone anywhere.
Oh, it could have gone much further than that. Yeah.
Unlimited capability. If you can I'll tell you what, the music tells us we're going to a break. So we'll continue our conversation about the capabilities of this amazing technology We'll get into the power source, Element 115, and then bring Gene Huff back into the conversation to talk about how the story broke and how your lives were changed forever and threats and all sorts of weird stuff going on. Stay with us. Roxette takes us into the break on Coast to Coast AM.